Before the break, we spoke with Miles Hyman about Illustrating the Lottery, that short story about herd mentality in a rural village, which was written by his grandmother, Shirley Jackson. Jackson's popular horror novels, like The Haunting of Hill House, We Have Always Lived in the Castle, and others, put a distinctly mid-century American twist on the hysterical and trapped female characters so popular in classic Gothic fiction. It may be hard to believe that the writer, derided as Virginia Werewolf, also supported her family by writing comic dispatches for women's magazines as a housewife trying to keep up with four rambunctious kids and a rambling old Vermont house. In a new biography, author Ruth Franklin explores those seemingly distinct, even contradictory genres as emblematic of the tension between creative fulfillment and the duties of motherhood that were simmering in an era when working mothers and working artists were so rare. Franklin's biography is called Shirley Jackson, A Rather Haunted Life. And in it, she presents Shirley Jackson's fiction as nothing less than the secret history of American women of her era. I spoke with Franklin just after talking with Miles about the lottery, so I began asking her about that story and how the notoriety and the disdain as the result of that story followed Shirley Jackson for the rest of her life.
Well, immediately she paid a price in terms of the hate mail she received for that story. The New Yorker would say that they got more letters in response to the lottery than they had ever before for any piece of fiction. And they forwarded them all on to Shirley Jackson, who actually kept them for the rest of her life in a big scrapbook that's now in her archive in the Library of Congress. And a lot of the letters were, in fact, letters of denunciation. People called her all kinds of names, said she was perverted. But a lot of them, the majority of them, actually were just confused. People were so bewildered by the lottery and the experience of reading it, and they wanted Shirley Jackson, or really anyone, to explain to them what it meant.
Well, along with that story, and the attention she got from it, along with The Haunting of Hill House and We Have Always Lived in the Castle, reinforced this image of her as a kind of macabre, gothic, kind of witchy writer. I think someone says that she writes with a broomstick, or they call her Virginia Werewolf.
Right, not with a pen, but a broomstick, they would say.
So, but she cultivated that in some ways, didn't she?
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, she enjoyed that aspect of her persona. The jacket copy of her first novel, it said that she's the only contemporary writer who is also a practicing amateur witch. Hmm. And, you know, she wrote that copy, or at least she wrote it probably together with her husband, Stanley Hyman, who also enjoyed this kind of tinkering with her image. But she really, you know, she was, in fact, a serious student of witchcraft. She had a big library of historical witchcraft chronicles and other books on the subject. And she enjoyed playing up that aspect of her persona to reporters. She loved to tell the story, for instance, of how she claimed to have broken the publisher Alfred Knopf's leg when he went skiing in Vermont. As it happens, you know, coincidentally or not so coincidentally, depending on how you see it, Knopf was involved with in a contract dispute with Stanley Hyman at the time, and then he went skiing and happened to break his leg. And Jackson would joke that she had to wait for him to go skiing in Vermont because she wasn't allowed to do witchcraft across state lines, as we all know. So, you know, she enjoyed playing up that aspect of her character, but as you point out, she also was the author of many more lighthearted stories about her family and her absent-minded professor husband and her big menagerie of pets, stories that were just eaten up by the readers of women's magazines at the time.
Let's go back to the further earlier life, which was dark in some ways. Her mother, Geraldine, was a socialite who went, I think, beyond the traditional expectations of femininity for her daughter. She was cruel, incessantly disapproving. How did Shirley carry that in her life?
Well, yes, Geraldine was very critical of Shirley from an early age. It seems quite clear that Shirley wasn't the daughter her mother had wanted her to be. Criticized her looks, her weight, her desire to sit around and daydream instead of going to social lunches and stuff like that. One of my favorite discoveries in Jackson's archive actually was a notebook in which she kept a diary during her teenage years. And on the cover of the notebook is a picture of a very proper-looking young woman with her hair nicely waved, wearing pearls. And underneath the picture is written the title, The Debutante. And someone, presumably the notebook's owner, took a very blunt pencil and very heavily scratched out the face of this nice young woman. And, you know, I feel like that kind of says everything that needs to be said about Shirley's opinion of her mother's desires for her and exactly how much she planned to go along with them. But it was a difficult relationship. Her mother really never let up on her criticism for the rest of Shirley's life. She would receive very critical letters about her writing or about her looks when photographs of her appeared in national magazines. And it was something that she seems always to have found very hurtful.
I'm speaking with the author Ruth Franklin about her biography of the author Shirley Jackson. It's called A Rather Haunted Life. But she rebelled still outwardly. You know, she became a writer. She put on weight. She married a Jewish intellectual, Stanley Hyman, who became professor at Bennington College. But this is a man who also was flagrantly and insistently unfaithful, really humiliating her, telling her about his sexual exploits, which caused her so much anguish. But she did go along with it. Why couldn't she leave him?
Well, I think, you know, it's an interesting and complicated question. And of course, it's so hard to try to understand what goes on in another person's marriage. But, you know, my guess at it would be initially when they first met, Stanley was a fairly committed communist who was a member of the Young Communist League, as, you know, so many young intellectuals were back then. And so he initially espoused the open relationship as a moral principle. Simply, he believed that there was no point in fidelity and that it was a, you know, an establishment capitalist construct that he need not obey. You know, and it became clear very early that Shirley didn't feel that way. And despite his attempts to convince her, she always was deeply hurt and distressed by his infidelities. And you know, that was a pattern that they continued to repeat throughout their relationship. But as I say in the book, I think they had a deep and intimate connection, both personally and intellectually. Stanley was a great critic who always appreciated Shirley's writing from literally the moment they met. He sought her out after reading a story she had written in a college literary magazine, which he admired at first sight. And he would always be a great champion of her work. He was a close reader of all her manuscripts, making lots of notes on them. She also read all his manuscripts. And so they had this kind of perfect symbiosis when their relationship was good of writer and critic, this wonderful intellectual connection that they also spread to their family life.
What I'm thinking about is the way that her work sometimes reflects, I think, what is going on in her life. You know, like, there are characters of women kind of, you know, constructing their own houses in the case of We Have Always Lived in the Castle, or kind of imprisoned by their own fears. And similarly, in small town New England, the idea of the locals having a kind of, I don't know, insidiousness about them. After The Lottery came out, you know, this portrayal of barbaric villagers, did people in Bennington take offense?
Well, I would say yes and no. I interviewed Larry Powers, who was the grocer in North Bennington for years and years, as was his father before him. And he insisted to me that he actually had never read The Lottery, which I found so telling, actually, that it, obviously it's a story that has attracted more attention, perhaps, than anything else by anyone who ever lived in North Bennington. And yet this man, who almost literally personifies the village, you know, rejects the very idea of it and says he won't read it. You know, many people believe that The Lottery was set in North Bennington. And in fact, when you look at the way the story describes the village square, it does very much resemble that village. But, you know, Jackson never actually came out and said that it was about North Bennington. She said all kinds of different things about the genesis of The Lottery, including that it had its roots in Winchester, New Hampshire, where she and Stanley had lived very briefly early on in their marriage before settling in North Bennington. But, you know, she also said that it was about anti-Semitism. You know, she gave all kinds of possible spins on the lottery. But, you know, in the end, I think part of the reason that the story has endured the way it has is that it is so general and can be assigned any number of different meanings.
Well, there's a story you tell us in the book about how the lottery was written that kind of does reveal this idea that it was in her role as a mother of four raucous, creative kids that kind of unlocked a creativity in her. Tell us about the day, as she tells it, she wrote the lottery.
Right. Well, as she tells it, she got the idea for the lottery while she was out doing errands one morning. And she had her daughter in a stroller at the time, and she came home and put her daughter in a playpen and just sat down at her typewriter and wrote the story. And she says that she was done by the time her older son came home from kindergarten for lunch. So I love that story because it shows us how she managed to fit in her creative life, you know, in the breaks, in those in-between times, you know, while one child is at school or another child is napping. And, you know, that's the way that so many women writers talk about working, you know, including Alice Munro, who once said that she started writing short stories because as a mother, she didn't have the long blocks of time she needed to write novels. And I see something similar going on in Shirley Jackson's life, that she adapted her working habits to the constraints of life with children, but that she also found something fruitful in those restraints. Her children describe her sitting on a stool in the kitchen with her notebook in her hand, jotting down, you know, ideas for plots or characters while she was cooking or doing whatever else she was doing at the time. I think that's such a wonderful image and such an apt description of how she, you know, managed to make it work.
So she's a human being with a great human range, a wildly imaginative person who's able to write a book like Life Among the Savages, but also The Lottery, which, as you know, a critic said, one is as different from the other as a thunderstorm from a zephyr. So how, in looking at the life of this woman, did you come to understand somebody who called herself this compound of creatures I call me?
You know, it's funny. Stanley Edgar Hyman actually has a wonderful line about her, which he wrote in an appreciation that he published after her death. To the critics who wondered how one writer could write in two such different styles, he said that expecting Shirley Jackson, because she was the author of these suspenseful tales, to be a dark and brooding witch was on the order of expecting Herman Melville to actually be a great white whale. And, you know, I think that's a wonderful line and, you know, gets at the heart of the disjunction between biography and fiction, in that, you know, we can't extrapolate easily from the conditions of a writer's life to that writer's work. It's reflected, of course, and we can try to follow the traces. But in the end, you know, creative work comes from a mysterious place, and it can't be easily located in, you know, different scenes from a writer's life.
Ruth Franklin, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about that life.
Thank you very much.
Ruth Franklin, she's author of the book Shirley Jackson, A Rather Haunted Life. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.